Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is journalist and author Catherine J. Prince. Prince has worked as a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in both Switzerland and New York, where she reported on the United Nations. She is the author of American Daredevil and Death in the Baltic, both of which we covered in past shows on Out of Bounds. Her most recent book, and what we'll be discussing on today's show, is Queen of the Mountaineers, the trailblazing life of Fanny Bullock Workman. Workman was an adventurer and mountain climber and a champion for women's rights in the Victorian era. Catherine Prince, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Now, you know what? I want to ask you, what led you to researching the life of Fanny Bullock Workman? Because I had never heard of her.
Sure. So for this book, I really felt this time I wanted to write at the centerpiece of my book about a woman who was strong and groundbreaking and, more importantly, that her story would resonate today in 2019. And so I was really looking to find someone who could fit that category for me. I had written in the past where women have been in my books, but never as the centerpiece.
Yeah.
And so when I came across Fanny, originally I came across the story of her cycling through India. And then I saw this photo of her with this really, you know, these heavy woolen pants and jacket. And I thought, this is really some woman. And then I read in the account that she had written about her ascent of the Matterhorn. And then I was hooked.
Oh, I can imagine. So we need to enlighten our listeners, because she was born in 1859, which I found remarkable.
That's right. So she was born in 1859 to a fairly wealthy family. And she grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. Her father became governor of Massachusetts. He was an abolitionist. And her maternal grandfather was actually the founder of a gunpowder company. But she's 19, and as many in her circles did, was sent abroad to Europe for finishing school. Yeah. Her parents hoped she would also get married, and she wasn't too interested in that. So she comes home and she's fluent in French and German, but no husband. And of course, then she does meet her husband, Hunter, who becomes a real partner for her.
Yeah, that's a fascinating relationship, too, because he was a lot like her father, right? I mean, he opposed slavery, believed in equality for all people, and he was a doctor, right?
That's right. So he's 12 years her senior. He's a doctor. He retires for some kind of unspecified ailment. And I don't know if that was just the two of them decided, you know, it's time we go to Europe and do what we want to do. But he was really ahead of his time in that sense, where he supports her and is happy to have her shine and become the face of their expeditions, et cetera. He's very supportive and very much shared her interest in travel and exploration.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how the two of them got involved in mountain climbing.
So going back to the India cycling trip, they're cycling from the southern tip through the northernmost reaches of India, and they're getting up into the northern part. It's summer. It's really hot, as you can imagine. And so she decides, you know, let's take a little bit of a detour. And so that's their first foray into climbing. And they go a little bit. They do get turned around because of weather, but that's when she decides, this is really what I want to do. And they leave aside the cycling, you know, trade the bikes for boots, and they will spend the next several years exploring many parts of the Himalaya together. She wanted to go where no one had been before and contribute to cartography and glacial science, et cetera.
God, it's an amazing story. I can't believe that people were able to do this in that era. You know, we have all these high-tech clothing, you know, it's amazing. How did they equip themselves and find out what they needed?
She did a lot of reading. They did start to, and he did too, they also started to acquaint themselves with mountain guides. Before they started, to backtrack a little bit, but before the big Himalayan expeditions, they had done the Alps. So she did do Mont Blanc and Matterhorn and the Jungfrau in Switzerland. So she got to know some people in the climbing community and guides there who they would later hire that helped also school them in what you needed to bring, which was, of course, everything. I mean, down to the chickens that they would, you know, slaughter along the way for food and sheep. And but it was also over time, you know, I could see with each expedition, she got a little bit more knowledgeable and they got more well-versed in what they needed to bring with them.
You know, and Else amazes me, I know her husband was supportive, but the wider culture, what did they think about a woman doing this?
Yeah, there was a lot of backlash initially. I mean, there was at one point where Queen Victoria wanted to forbid, you know, not just women, but men too, but from climbing. But in terms of women, there was all sorts, even with the cycling, you know, that could be dangerous for your health and for your sanity. And we laugh now, but in a way, I feel we shouldn't laugh because we get a lot of these arguments today, not about cycling, but
yes,
about what women should or shouldn't do. And certainly there was, you know, later insinuations and questions raised. You know, here's a mother who is leaving her children for months at a time. And, you know, she'll face scrutiny the way that men who were doing expeditions at the time who had children, no one thought anything of.
Yeah, yeah. I was amazed at how brave she was. I can't imagine tackling some of these Alps and unknown places like she did. It really quite courageous.
For me, there was this one scene that she is going across this roaring river on this rope bridge, which is basically, you know, five thick ropes sort of twisted around. That's what she would walk on. And the handrails are the same, and it's undulating, and it's swaying back and forth. And then she just writes really just dry wit of, you know, basically, well, that was tough, but big deal. And I'm thinking, I don't know. I think I would have sat down on the side of the river. And
I know it.
Incredibly brave.
Yeah, and skilled, too, because bravery and making it happen are two different things, you know. I mean, she could have failed so easily during some of these perilous trips. And I love the way you describe them in the book.
Oh, thank you.
I want to bring up the fact that she had this huge rival, a woman named Annie Peck. Tell us about that story and about Annie.
Sure. So Annie Peck was born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island. And unlike Fanny's parents, Peck's parents didn't initially support her ambition. They believed higher education was a waste for women. Annie really wanted to go on to university like her brothers. And so she persisted till her father finally relented and she was admitted to University of Michigan. Yeah. And that drive and persistence was very representative of Peck. And so time and again, she tried to summit Mount Huascarán in Peru. And that was the climb that pits her against Fanny Workman for the altitude record. Peck also believed women should be judged for their accomplishments, just like Workman. And interestingly, the two refrained from really going after each other with personal attacks during this big dispute. They didn't ever meet. They did not like each other from what they had read and what they knew about each other. But they still also really tried to keep that personal out of the dispute and keep it just about the numbers, you know, who climbed higher.
Yeah.
And they both wanted that rivalry to be about their achievement and not about the fact that they happened to be two women. And I think the other thing that was really interesting, so of course that dispute over the records, but they were also polar opposites. Fanny is moneyed and she's married and she has children. And Peck is single and childless and has to eke out a living. And so through these women, I think we also get a real sense for some of the discussions and debates we're having today about professional women and motherhood and privilege. And so the two of them really serve as, I think, good illustrations of that as well.
You know, probably I would think while I was reading your book that the rivalry might have helped them continue their exploration, you know, it was like a motivation in some ways.
Oh, yeah. I always kind of had this sense that although they hadn't met, that each one kind of feels the other one breathing down their neck a little bit. So, you know, gives them that extra push to do what they did. And it did also, because it was such a public dispute, I think it really showed that women belonged on the mountain, or if they wanted to cycle or whatever, you know, pursuit they wanted, that it showed that women belonged in all these different spheres.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in that era, how did they get publicity for this? Because I know they were invited to do lectures and give talks and show photos of their travels. How did they get publicity? Were they sending press releases?
Not quite press releases, but they would sometimes write their own, you know, stories and accounts and then get them published. And so work out deals with, say, Harper's Magazine, for example. So they were both very good at that. And they were both good at cultivating press and interviews. So I don't think, you know, not press releases like we think of today, but they did have relationships with newspapers that would cover their exploits. And then Annie wrote a couple books. Fanny and her husband co-authored 8 books on the climbs. And those books also then would help, because then there would be talk and little blurbs about the books coming out. So that was one way that they got press. And another interesting thing with Annie was she was once used in a promotional for Singer sewing machines. And it kind of looks like little trading cards, you know, like baseball trading cards. And so she had that as well that helped.
You know, I was really interested in the fact that Annie Peck, like you said, climbed the Matterhorn. Tell me about that. I didn't even think that had been explored much in that era.
Yeah, so it was just starting to get, you know, people were climbing it. And they both did it, and now, right now I can't remember if it was on that climb, but they ended up sharing a guide later on that they both used in their bigger expeditions. And the Matterhorn, which is just over, I want to say it's like over 14,000 feet or so, is not an easy descent. I mean, it's not like what she did in the Himalayas, 23,000 feet and higher, but it was an overnight. They leave before dawn, you know, get kind of halfway up and they sleep over, they get to the top, and they both faced a really, really rough descent. And I think that climb showed them that the descent could be even more arduous than the ascent, and that, you know, a lot of danger, a lot of mistakes can happen in the descent. And so they both learned a lot from that and used it to, you know, make them more skillful in their later, more ambitious climbs.
Yeah, and then they learned from their guides too, right? I mean, in some ways, mm-hmm. life and death tricks on how to survive. Tell us about the relationship with the guides. Was it easy for women?
Not easy for women. Both of them encountered guys who did not like being told, you know, to put it mildly, what to do by the woman who is the lead of the expedition. So they definitely encountered that resistance, subtle, not insurgency, but on the mountain. And in terms of the workmen's, I mean, the workmen's also, to their detriment, brought colonial attitudes to the guides, and not so much the guides who were European, but some of the porters that they would hire in India to go with them. So there was an element of class and, I think, colonial attitude towards some of their porters as well. But the guides, in terms of her being a woman, there's a scene in the book where she gets in a really big fight with this Swiss guide she had hired. And, you know, he just didn't want to listen to her, but eventually he comes to respect her.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Catherine Prince. We're talking about her new book, Queen of the Mountaineers, The Trailblazing Life of Fanny Bullock Workman. Fascinating story about a woman mountain climber in the Victorian era. I wanted you to talk about frostbite and how they sustain themselves during this era. I mean, it had to have been really epic to not lose a limb.
Oh, absolutely. There's many times where she's climbing and, you know, you get these pictures of her just windmilling her arms, or they're banging their hands together, feet together, because the equipment is not what we have today. And on the climb that she ultimately does get her altitude record, she later, you know, one evening she's writing in her journal how she just wishes someone would invent boots that could keep someone's feet warm at 20,000 feet.
Wow, yeah.
And of course, that exists today. But they would do all kinds of things. I mean, she would wear these fur-lined rubber mittens and put those, you know, into another layer. So really layering up. Frostbite was really a life or death situation. And there was the guy that they both shared, actually, on Amy Peck's, one of her climbs, he ended up losing a foot and a hand to frostbite.
Yeah.
So that's incredibly dangerous. And then in terms of just the food and sustaining themselves, they would bring tins and ship tins of food with them. So if anyone knows, like, the Shackleton story, you know, they had tins of tongue and beef and veggies. But the big thing that they used, there were these, like, beef lozenges. So if you can think of, like, a beef-flavored gummy bear sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think Haribo is going to come out with that anytime soon.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That was something that they used. They also had cola biscuits.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, tell us about them.
So cola biscuits had a bit of coca bean, it's not really cocaine, but in the biscuits, but that was kind of an energy biscuit, kind of like, I guess, an energy bar of today. They would eat those. And the other one was this plasmin chocolate that they came across that they would also eat for like a quick bit of energy. And then a little interesting footnote there was that Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, had at one point, you know, invested in this plasmin chocolate company. I don't know how long he stayed an investor in that, but so those were little things that they would do. And the other thing that I loved that the workmen's had was what she called Hunter's medicinal tea. So, so occasionally when they would get back into camp at night, he would heat up their Primus stove, and she had this tea kettle she brought everywhere. And he would, boil the water and quickly dunk in his tea bag, but a little ball with the tea leaves in it, take it out, and then it was, you know, mostly like hot whiskey. That was their medicinal tea they would drink at night sometimes.
Oh, I can imagine. I'm sure that saved them oftentimes. You know what I was wondering? You know, you see people nowadays walking around with their plastic bottles of water. How did, besides having to heat the water up if it was frozen, how did they sustain themselves in regard to liquids during the climbs?
Yeah, they had these different canteens, and they would try different ones that they would bring with them and then refill. So, you know, refillable water bottle in a sense. Some of them were canvas lined to prevent leakage. Some were just, you know, those sort of metal. I don't know if you ever had one as a kid.
Yes, canteens.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, probably a little bit bigger. So they use the flasks or canteens to keep water with them while they were going.
You know what I'm very interested in? Because you mentioned the fact that Peck wore trousers and Fanny didn't. But you talked about how cops would often arrest women in trousers in that era. To tell us about that, that is remarkable.
Yeah. So as women started going from, you know, these long full skirts at the end of the Victorian era, the women start experimenting with, you know, the bloomers come later with Amelia bloomers. But for cycling, for example, women might want something they called these sort of cycling kind of very flowy trousers. And women start wearing trousers, and they do. In some states, there are laws about what you can and cannot wear. And there were places where wearing bifurcated garments, as they were called, would be considered, was illegal. It was considered immodest and immoral. There was, articles written how that could contribute to the fall of our civilization and society.
The scary thing is we still hear that.
Yes. Yeah. And that was something through the writing and the research that so many of these arguments are not ended. You know, they weren't resolved necessarily.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I find also kind of puzzling is the fact that a lot of people don't know about these two women. You know, it's not like Shackleton and some of the more famous male climbers. Do you think that has to do with sexism primarily, or a lack of interest in women's history? Well, what do you think?
I think it's absolutely a combination of both. I think that, you know, in every sport, women have faced sexism and starting to get rectified now. We're really hearing much more now about current female climbers. You know, Melissa Arnault comes to mind, for example, or the young girl, 10 years old, who just climbed El Capitan, youngest person ever. Arlene Bloom, who was first woman to head an all-female team up Annapurna. But I think there's been sexism in just in women's history not being taught. You know, we don't know so much about the women who have contributed to so many aspects, not just politics, but sports and literature and science, et cetera. You know, a few names kind of filter out, but so many have just been lost because of that.
Absolutely. And you're one of the people trying to rectify that by writing a book like this. Tell us how you did your research on these women who are not, like we said, very well known.
Right. Not household names. Hopefully now they will be. But So for Annie Peck's papers are in Brooklyn College. So I did many trips out to Brooklyn College to read through all her papers, her correspondence, photographs, et cetera. And for Fannie Bullock Workman, they are all in the National Library in Edinburgh, Scotland. And so it was a trip to Scotland to go through her papers. And also Hunter's papers are there as well. And then through, you know, American Alpine Club, there's a UK Alpine Club that was really helpful for me, interviewing people who are climbers just about, you know, effects of altitude and what's changed, what's not changed. So reaching out to people in the climbing community, then some different smaller historical societies to find, you know, what I could about each of the women from, you know, where they were born.
That must be fascinating. What was the most surprising thing you found just sort of out of the blue?
A couple of the things that I found that surprised me. One was Hunter, in the really learning that I think we would call him a feminist today. And that was really surprising. I mean, I knew he supported his wife, because he was on these trips with her, but the degree to which he supported her and encouraged her. And then also they had their daughter. They had two children, and only Rachel lived into adulthood. And when Rachel gets married, he's writing her these letters that were really beautiful and warm to me, you know, telling her, you know, that your allegiance has to change a little because now you're getting married, but also, you know, being true to who you are and what you want to do. And that was surprising to me, given that this is in the early 1900s.
Yeah. Oh, the whole story is surprising to me. What is the legacy of Fannie Workman and Annie Peck in regard to being suffragettes and believing in women's rights and so on? And how does that meld in with this climbing career?
I think that it comes in with the whole thought again of one pursuing one's passion or profession, vocation, for what you want to do. That one should, you know, be determined and purposeful because that's what you want, and not following what society dictates what you do. And that might mean different things for different women. So neither of them is judging, you know, are judging people for having children, not having children, pursuing careers or not. It's really just this should be open if you want to do this, whether it was climbing or going to university. Later, Annie Peck gets involved in campaigning against World War I. also having a political voice. But again, it was all just, you know, one should be judged on one's merits alone and on one's achievements alone, and whatever that meant for a particular person. You know, it didn't have to be climbing 23,000 plus feet. It could be, you know, running a little business or whatever, but they just certainly weren't, I think they weren't judging what you did as a woman, but just that you should be able to do.
Well, I think that's fascinating that they were concerned about the wider world and women in the wider world instead of just their own pursuits. The fact that they were involved in these issues said to me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and sometimes, as I said, you know, Fanny was complicated because she could be situational with her sense of social justice. But the fact that in 1895, she talks about how a country would be judged on the way it treats its women, I thought, you know, kind of sums it all up. And that was 1895.
Tell us about the time she actually put a flag up and said, give women the vote, or something like that.
Yeah, that was on one of her last climbs. And there's this really beautiful photo of her because she's just isolated on this peak, and she's got her woolen climbing skirt and her big bulky woolen jacket and her, you know, sort of helmet with the I don't even know what's all over it. And she's holding aloft this banner that says vote for women. And she gets photographed, and you know, such an iconic photo. And that's around 1911.
That amazed me the most in this book, I have to admit.
Yeah.
Quite the activist.
She was. And knocking down doors of some of the societies in Europe that tell her you can't speak here. And then she persists, and she becomes the first woman to speak at the Sorbonne and the second one to the Royal Geographic Society. So she, you know, does not take no for an answer.
Yeah. And she had to be that way, I assume, in that era. But to tell us, I know they both, between the two of them, published many books. You mentioned it before. Mm-hmm. Are they still in print? Are they still being read? Are they taught in any schools or anything like that?
They're not. You can get reprints of the books. So that's what I did for some of them and found some of them used. They're not, to my knowledge, and so I could be wrong, but to my knowledge, they're not being taught and they're not being used in schools. But that I'm, you know, if someone knows otherwise, that would be great to know.
Yeah, and maybe this book will change that. Well, Catherine, we are almost out of time. Can you just tell us real briefly what you might be working on next?
Well, I'm still really in early stages of research, so I'm a little hesitant to say. I will just say that I'm looking into Vietnam, but of course that's a huge answer. So that's about all I want to say right now.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, Catherine Prince, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure, and this book is fascinating. I really encourage people to go out and buy Queen of the Mountaineers, The Trailblazing Life of Fanny Bullock Workman. And thank you so much, Catherine, for joining us.
Thank you, Tish. It was a pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.